So as you can, I'm sure you've already gotten the impression, there's a lot of information being thrown at you in a short period of time. The good news is that all of this information is pretty much available to you when you're being a docent right where you're working. So there's a bunch of information here. Heather and her team put together the binder and the information that's on the docent desk in there. Additionally, a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about here, some of it I went over on the boat, but I figured going over it twice isn't that big deal. Probably helps. A lot of it's on the panels right over there behind this side of the aquariums. Those are food webs and local fish. And then the timeline is all around inside that room. And when the touch screen is working, I highly recommend, if you don't have visitors in here, watching the videos. It's a lot of really good information on those, and the more you hear it, and it's different people, it's not just me talking, you get a lot of the information to understand the stories that are going on. And what I found that works really well trying to convey things to people that have just come to the lake and may not know the lake very well is telling them a story about one particular thing. Maybe it's the building that Heather was just talking about, how if you were sitting here 10 years ago, you'd have mice underneath your feet, you'd be kicking the raccoons. Now it looks like this. So you can tell them the story that it was a fish hatchery, the process that it went through, and their questions will lead you into whatever you want to talk to them about next. But I'm going to talk, because we did a clarity reading out there. And this just gives you some visuals that I can't do when I'm on the boat. But we talked about this. So what limits transparency of water? You have the surface of the water, and you have the sunlight coming down through it. There's molecular scattering of just the water itself. So if you had pristine water out there with no particles in it, you ran it through a filter and put it out there, the deepest Secchi readings you can get are right around 40 to 45 meters. And there's limits to that because molecular scattering of just the water itself. Then what we add to that is particulate light scattering, that's the particles coming to light that we talked about, and particulate light absorption, where the particles actually absorb the sunlight. And then what passes through is your transmitted light. The more transmitted light that goes down, the deeper you can see the Secchi disk, because you have more light reflecting off that disk. This we looked at, just the change over time. The really good story is that back in 2005, right about here, this trend line used to be straight. For those of you that were watching Jeff's talk this week saw that. And the best fit for this line used to be a straight line. And by now, we'd be somewhere up here on average. Well, we're not. We started getting a whole bunch of these annual Secchi readings that were below that straight trend line. And so took all the data, redid the calibrations and statistics, and the best fit is now this curved line, which means we have a decrease in clarity loss. That's good news. And what we just saw up there today, we got both groups are right around 26 meters. So we're done here. And this is about the worst Secchi readings we'll have for the whole year. Why is it the worst we have for the whole year?
Spring runoff.
We've gone through spring runoff. We've got high sunlight. We're getting algae growth. All the nutrients are now in the lake. This is as bad as it gets this year. You're absolutely right. This is our winter trend. Again, you may have seen this before, but even better news, our winter clarity is getting better. Okay, this is kind of another graphic example of how this works. The green is concentration of fine particles. And so what you see is, this is January, and it goes through the monthly through the year. So January, February, March, really, no particles in the water column, very few. You don't see any green over here. And that's when we have our best Secchi readings. Then this could also be when you start getting that lake mixing. And you see these dots are the Secchi readings for those times. So you have very deep Secchi readings when there's no, in late February, early March, where there's no particles in. We get to springtime, April, May. We start getting our streams input into the water. And this is the fine particles coming in, and they're in the shallow surface water. High concentrations. Then what happens as we go through the summer is those particles start to settle, and the algae starting to settle as well. And that's why you see this spread out over a longer period of time. So if you were to do a second reading here, before you had the particles, it would be deep. If you were to do one here, these particles are between the surface and your secchi depth. So they play a big role. When you get over here, the particles are spread out a lot, so you don't have the highest concentration, but you're starting to grow algae in this area as well. And then you get into the later in the year, and the particles become so diluted they don't even show up on the graph anymore. So it's just another graphical way of showing how it happens, how the worst surface conditions happen in the springtime, and what we've been going over. And this is the same thing with temperature. So again, winter months, same temperature top to bottom. Basically looking at this below 45, somewhere in the low 40s, 41 degrees. This is when you can have that lake mixing we talked about, where when the wind blows at that time, you can actually take water from greater than 300 meters all the way down to 450 meters and bring it back up to the surface again. And when we are in August, September, we have that uncomfortably hot water that we have to swim in up at the surface. And if you put a bunch of wind on top of this, right around 20, 22 meters is our thermocline, you're just not going to be able to break through that barrier. I think one of the groups we talked about this a little bit. We were talking about coring in the lake. This is actually a picture of our box core. It is sitting right over there, so you can get an actual look at it. And it's got big trap doors on the bottom, so we open those up. It's got big steel or ledge plates on the side. And we lower it down, and it just kind of settles itself into the sediment. We send a messenger down that closes the trap doors, and we bring up about a 1.5 square foot chunk of the bottom. Then we can take separate tubes and run them down into it and take multiple cores out. So that's actually how that's worked. And it's not going to show up on here. You get a pretty good idea over an incline with the mock-up core that we have over there. But if you can see this picture on a computer where you have better visual, this is a really brown, rusty cap right at the top. And that's that oxygenated cap that I talked about. And then it turns gray, and the rest of the column is the gray, silty material. So there's a lot of nutrients that are trapped in this sediment layer. And if we were to lose this oxygenated cap, those would be able to release back into the water. So that's why we don't want to inhibit our lake mixing. We want lake mixing because that takes oxygenated surface water and puts it all the way down to the bottom of the lake. And that is very happy, muddy research here. Okay, I did not talk about this on the lake because I wanted to talk about it in here. We do a cooperative project with NASA. It's been going on for about 15 years, maybe a little more now. And some of you may be aware that we have buoys out on the lake. Those buoys are associated with this cooperative NASA project. So there are four in the northern part of the lake, these four here, TB1234. And this is how it's sitting in the Truckee River, just to give you bearing. On the boat, we were right out, or right about here. And then we have TBR1 and 2, which are solely UC Davis buoys. TBR1 and 2 have they have weather stations on them, so we know what the wind speed is on the lake, temperature, dew point, basic weather stations there. Those are some of the data that we use for looking at how the winds create these gyres in the lake. What were the wind conditions out on the lake when we're seeing what our drifters are doing? But I'm going to focus more on the northern ones, the NASA ones. And what NASA is doing is they're calibrating their satellites here at Lake Tahoe. So they had several different versions of the satellite, the MODIS, the Aster, and Landsat. And these various satellites fly around the Earth and take pictures of the Earth. And what they have instruments on them that are measuring the Earth's surface temperature. And when they were put up there, it was 15 years ago, all instruments tend to drift a little bit over time. I don't know about you guys, my bathroom scale does it daily. So these temperature variations are critical if you're trying to measure the Earth's surface temperature and changes in it, because climate change, we're looking at tenths of a degree of change. But if your instrument is varying by tenths of a degree, you can't for sure say that it's climate change. So they have to calibrate it. And it's really hard for them to run up to the satellite and test it. So they have to ground truth it. So what they're doing is using these buoys. That's just a pretty picture. These buoys. These are the northern ones. They're fairly large. Then that's one of the biggest ones down in the south. And they chose Lake Tahoe because it's at a high elevation. So when the satellite goes over, it takes a reading of Lake Tahoe's surface temperature. And it doesn't have to shoot through as much atmosphere, so it's getting a more accurate reading of the surface of Lake Tahoe. They wanted a water body because water doesn't change temperature very quickly. If you will go out there and you measure the temperature in the middle of the night versus the middle of the day, it's very, very close. Land temperatures tend to change radically. Land puts out a lot of heat at night. And Tahoe doesn't freeze. I'll give the NASA guys some credit. They know what the temperature of ice is, and they don't need to measure it for 9 months a year. So that's the beauty of Tahoe, is that they can calibrate these satellites anytime that satellite flies by you now. And we get roughly 300 clear days a year. So when the satellite does fly over, it is going to get a thermal picture of Lake Tahoe. You probably wouldn't want to do this in the Northeast. You might have 40 days, where you're getting a clear 20 by 20 mile picture of the Earth. So the instruments on here, they vary, and they're all battery powered. So inside the buoy well, there's a channel that goes down, and there's four large deep cycle car batteries in there. Those are being recharged by the solar panels, and the batteries are then providing power for all the instrumentation. There are about four or five different ways they're measuring the temperature of the surface of the lake. And the most important are the radionics, which are in these boxes out here. They measure the infrared heat coming off the surface of the lake. And that's the same way the satellites are measuring it. So that's their truest representation of what the satellites are seeing. And unfortunately, they aren't waterproof. So as you can see, this was after following a winter storm, and the spray goes at least halfway up the buoy. I've seen it go all the way to the top, where there's gigantic icicles hanging off of these things. And because they're not waterproof, they're in housings, but they have to be able to see the surface of the lake, so there are holes in the housings, and our job is to keep these instruments going. So it's a constant battle out there, keeping everything dry, running, and reading accurately. Well, there's some side bonuses to what we get to see from this data. The project was to calibrate the satellites, and that's why it's there, and that's working beautifully. But we also get images like this when the satellites fly by. So this is a thermal image of Lake Tahoe. If I was trying to create this in the boat, and I left Tahoe City, and I started racing around taking temperatures all around the lake, by the time I got to South Shore, it would be noon. And then when I got up there, it would be 3, and by the time I got back, it would be 5 o'clock. And the temperature does shift. I wouldn't know, I'd be off by a degree or two with the surface temperature. The satellite just takes a picture. This is what the surface temperature was all over the lake. So when we first saw these, this was one of the images we saw. When we looked at it and went, that's really kind of interesting. It was really cold up the west shore. What was going on? Why was it so cold on the west shore when the rest of the lake was kind of warmer? Any ideas? What's that?
Wintertime, shade,
snow melt?
It wasn't wintertime or snow melt. This was a bright, sunny day. It was a day like today, but probably in the afternoon.
Wind.
We have strong southwest winds, and what happened was all of this warm water is being pushed across the lake, and this is an upwelling event. So we're actually seeing cold, deep water come up from depth because of an upwelling. So when we saw that, you'd never be able to detect that when you're running around in a boat. But when you have a picture like this, well, wow, this satellite data could be really valuable. The other image we saw, taken a different time of year, and all of the south shore is very warm. It's kind of a yellowy orange color. But there's two tracks in it like this that are bright blue tracks. Any idea what those were? They're in the lake. Headed to the same point across the lake.
Water bikes.
Yeah.
It's probably the boats of the tourists.
Exactly. It's big paddle boats. And their props were digging up enough cold water that it showed up on a satellite image from space. And they were converging on Emerald Bay. So when we saw that image, we went, wow, not only can we see this kind of whole wave pattern of what's going on, but the resolution is good enough, we can see boat wakes from big boats. There's a lot we can do with this data. And so I'll get into the next presentation a little bit. It's about invasive species. And UNR started using a lot of this temperature data to build models and predict where warm water fish would show up around the lake. And all of that data was coming from these NASA flyovers. The other exciting thing that's kind of being developed now is they're still working on it, but this color around the shoreline is different levels of chlorophyll, which is representative of the amount of algae or aquatic plants that are in the water. So these are not on shore, these are actually underwater. And it would be really great if we could get better resolution on these, where the satellites would be able to determine the density of algal growth around the shoreline of Lake Tahoe. And they're already starting, we're not that far away from getting that kind of data. The best part of that is that Scott Hackman and I wouldn't have to go snorkeling in February to find out. We could just ask the satellites. So this gets into the periphyton. This periphyton is attached algae. And we sample that, unfortunately, from November through May. So when it's really nice out there and that uncomfortably hot water, we don't get to get in it. We're out there in the wintertime. That's when the algae starts to grow. And it peaks with spring runoff, peaking in March to April. This is what you would normally expect Tahoe to look like, and it does during the wintertime. Beautiful, clean rocks. And then later in winter and starting in the spring, you get this nice bright green, fuzzy growth on the rocks. I'm sure a lot of you have seen that. This picture doesn't show up well on the screen, but we get a species out there called Gomphinaeus, and it can grow up to like 3 inches long. It's kind of a whitish tan, very slimy, and it's waving around on top of the rocks. We get that when we have higher nutrient loads coming into the lake. And it's short-lived. So what it tends to do, the green stuff tends to stay on the rocks. The white stuff, by this time of year, it sloughs off. It has a lot of gases trapped in it. And it floats up, and then you end up seeing these mats of algae floating along the shoreline. It's very unsightly. So what we do is we go out, and we have a grid. And specific stations we go around to, there's 10 stations around the lake. And we put the grid down and we determine the amount of algal cover on the rocks. And then you have a very fancy syringe toothbrush combination where we put it onto the rock and we use a toothbrush to spin around inside the tube. We suck up the algae that we scraped off the rock, and it's from a known area. So we actually measure exactly how much biomass, how much material is there, and how much chlorophyll was in that material at the sites around the lake. Any questions on periphyton? You've all seen it, I'm sure, the algae on the rocks. You'll get a lot of comments on that. A lot of it is It's worse now than I've ever seen it. And we hear that one a lot. Now, our data doesn't necessarily show that. It seems to be relatively constant over time, at least as far as the amount of it that's there. But my theory, my personal theory, is that we get a lot more people visiting the shoreline in March and April than we used to. March used to be a big ski time. And now March is kind of the end of the ski season. And people that are up here are spending time at the lake instead of up on the mountain. So they're seeing those bright green rocks that they didn't used to see. But it's somewhat debatable whether our data is reflecting exactly what has happened, but we've been doing this for 30 years now, measuring this periphyte, and we cannot determine that there's more now than there used to be. So zooplankton, copepod, can't copepod. Sorry. So this is Mysa shrimp. And these are the guys that were introduced into the lake in order to feed the fish. They were put in the 1960s. And that'll be in the timeline as well. And it wasn't just Tahoe that they were put in. They were putting them into all sorts of different western lakes in order to be a primary fish food, because they wanted to grow bigger fish faster in all these western lakes. And first thing you kind of notice about these guys, they have enormous eyes. They're very sensitive to light. So they're down deep on the bottom during the daytime. At night, they come up to the surface. We go out at night and we collect them. And the story of the mysis is when they got put into the lake, they basically ate all of our daphnia, which were our slow-moving zooplankton. They were the primary fish food. Best example of the effect it had is it went up the food chain to the kokanee salmon that are in the lake. And the kokanee used to be around 5 pounds in Lake Tahoe, feeding on daphnia. These guys came in, ate the daphnia, left those very quick, rapidly moving zooplankton that we saw today. Kokanee have a much harder time eating them, and now the average kokanee size is down around 1 pound. And they went from about 18 inches down to about 10 or 11. And there's some rare exceptions that happened last year. We got a state record kokanee out of the lake. So things may be changing a little bit, but basically these guys eliminated the food supply for a lot of the fish that relied on the zooplankton. Okay, we do get to play with aquatic plants too. It is an ugly job. This is what you look like when you come out of diving in the Tahoe Keys. There's invasive aquatic plants, and there's aquatic plants that are native to Tahoe. So not every aquatic plant out there is necessarily invasive. But those that are tend to grow up relatively high off the bottom. They get fouled in the boat props, as you can see here. And that prop stops spinning, it's just going to suck up a bunch of those plants. And then the problem is, if you go to another lake, you're taking those plants with you. Or if you go to another part of Tahoe, you're taking those plants with you. And there's the two main ones are curly leaf pondweed and Eurasian water milfoil. There's others, but those are the ones that are the biggest issue here in Tahoe. Both of them are very good at regenerating. So if you take just one little piece of Eurasian water milfoil and it settles down in the right habitat, it'll grow a whole new plant. Pondweed has these little pieces, they're like almost like pine cones, they're called turions. And they settle on the bottom and they grow a whole new plant. And these plants they don't want to die. They can go to the surface and flower and reproduce sexually. They can break off and start a new plant. And they also send out roots for rhizome generation. So they have multiple ways of spreading. It's not just you go in there and pluck a few plants and you're done. And they have had some very good success using barriers over the top of the plants. And coupled with hand removal in Emerald Bay to eliminate the Eurasian water milfoil that got into Emerald Bay. It's an ongoing process, it's been about 5 years, but they've taken it back dramatically. The interesting thing with that, I don't know if they show up, but here's a bluegill, here's your largemouth bass. They love the plant habitat. So when you get these plant beds out in the lake, you're creating habitat for these other warm water invasive species to then thrive out in the lake. When they culled back, virtually eliminated the plants from Emerald Bay, the numbers of warm water invasive species, warm water fish, has dropped. They don't see them in there anymore. There's probably a few around, but they just don't see them. So there's definitely connections where one invasive species is really good at facilitating the success of other invasive species. These are just other topo oddities that I threw in because you may get questions from people. This is like a big green jelly ball. We hear it maybe once a year, somebody mentions something about it. But they're bryozoans, they're a multi-celled communal organism. And most people think it's like fish eggs or frog eggs or something like that. It has that consistency. But it's actually an individual organism. And they are indicative of clean, healthy systems, clean, healthy water. You find them in mountain lakes. You don't tend to find them. You wouldn't find it in Folsom Reservoir or something down in the Central Valley. You wouldn't find them in Pyramid Lake where you have high alkalinity. So they are... they're fine, they're known to be there, they're meant to be there, but they look weird when people, when they see them, they're like, wow, what's this? The other thing Tahoe has that very few people know about are sponges. And interesting, at Tahoe, they grow on the underside of the big boulders, and they're down about 30 feet deep. So it's usually scuba divers that encounter them. Snorkelers and swimmers generally don't see them. But it's a common species, it's Spongilla. The common lake sponge. And where they're more common is if you hike up to Eagle Lake above Emerald Bay, they're all over there. They grow a little differently. They grow in like green fingers off of the rocks and the woody debris in the lake. You can also find them in the lakes up above Meeks Bay and Stag Lake and Genevieve up in there. So not uncommon, but people don't necessarily think about it. Then when they see it, they think they're bright green. Wow, what's this bright green thing doing here? And they're just a native sponge that grows. In Tahoe, the reason they're on the underside of the rock is because they're inhibited by the UV. So the water's so clear that they basically have to grow back in the shadows. And the reason they're green is they have a symbiotic relationship with algae. So the algae grows within the sponge and turns it green. And when you go far enough back under the rock, where there's not enough light for the algae to grow, the sponge just transitions into a yellow and then a white. So it's the same sponge community. That's it for that part. Any questions?
Do you have any comments about like pollen season and how pollen affects
We just kind of went through it, as you know, and we get these big yellow mats out on the surface of the lake of pollen. And the thing about the pollen grains is that they're enormous compared to the particles that are clouding our water clarity. So they settle out pretty quickly. So they, in the near shore or even out in the lake, I guess they could have a short-term effect on water clarity. But they settle out pretty fast because they're big. I don't know the exact size of a pollen grain, but I'm guessing it's on the neighborhood of 10 to 100 times larger than the particles we're looking at that cloud the lake. And the ones we're concerned about, the 5 to 10 micron particles, they're so small that they continually get resuspended by the smallest currents. So they persist in the one, they sink very slowly because they're so small. They persist for a long time, whereas the pollen is kind of there, visible, and then it's gone. Yeah.
How do they anchor the buoys in the deep water?
With an anchor.
Okay.
it's kind of an amazing process, but we took those buoys out and they're actually anchored in place. There's a little bit of scope on the line so they can maybe move 100 feet in any one direction. But we do get comments about people saying, hey, your buoy has moved. And what they're really seeing is they're mistaking one buoy for the other, not knowing there's spore out there. But they'll move 100 feet or so. And the shallow ones are in about 1,500 feet of water, and the deep ones are in about 1,600 feet of water. When we put them out there, it was kind of interesting. We had to use two boats. We took the buoy was on the big boat and the anchor was on the big boat. But you can imagine 1,500 feet of line trying to put it out. You can't just pay it off the side of the boat. And we didn't want there to be any kink in the line because it would just snap if you're not the weight of those anchors. So what we did is we ran the line out to our small boat, tied it off, ran it back to the buoy that was tied to the big boat. When they kicked the weight over on the big boat, the line just started shooting across toward the small one, so we quickly cut that line with a knife, and then it shot back over and the buoy stood up. So the line went, so we knew it was straight and not kinked or coiled in any way. It came across and went back and the buoy was in place. And I don't want to do it again. It's pretty scary. Yeah.
Could you explain what they did at Emerald Bay? I a little bit more, you mentioned that about the business.
Yeah, the plants in Emerald Bay?
Yeah, what happened there?
So what they did is these are rubber pine liners here that you can take a look at. These were used for the clams and still are being used for the invasive clams and the like. The plants, they don't use something as heavy duty. So they're using more of a canvas. And it settles down on top of the plants, and it just eliminates the amount of light that's getting to them. And the plants die underneath these barriers. And then they have to go back and just make sure that they pick up any that weren't covered, or if they spread at all, that they hand dig those out and collect them all. And they've been very successful. It's taken several years, but each year there's fewer and fewer plants. And now I talked to one of the divers, and over a large section of the bay, they found one plant that they hand removed. So they've had very good success with that. The clams have been less successful in Emerald Bay. These barriers work very well in other parts of the lake, but Emerald Bay is a tricky situation where the clams are there, so they're not quite as effective.
Your specific question regarding the Eurasian water milfoil that you mentioned, is that what you're asking about? Because what they did was the plant had kind of gotten in there from the top of Keys from Boat Spring we did, and it had taken over in Emerald Bay. And so we actually have a picture at the other facility that shows just how covered it was. And they went in with a diver in a section, a vacuum, and they hand pulled each individual plant and sucked them up so that they knew they'd get every little piece of the plant. And over a 2-year period or 3-year period, they got it all. And there's a before and after picture that is amazing. But I don't think I have it here, but it's definitely in fun.
We should have Dan Shaw do a video for us on our screen.
Yeah.
Because it was really, it's a really nice success program.
Yeah.
In a relatively confined small area. But very effective. Yeah.
What kind of cooperative interaction do you have with TRPA?
A lot. And does everybody know who TRPA is? Tahoe Regional Planning Agency? Yeah. Most of our interaction with them is that they have the money and we're trying to spend it. But they want the answers and we're trying to provide them. So again, it goes back to kind of the applied projects that the research is doing. So, I can think of an example. Well, the clams are an example where TRPA was wanting to do projects to find out if there's ways to kill the invasive clam in the bottom of the lake. And so we did the research along with the University of Nevada, Reno, came up with these pond liners, put them down, looked at it. They were very effective. They were killing 99% of the clams underneath them in only 3 months. And said, this will work. The problem is your extent of your clams is huge. And you can't basically pave the entire lake bottom with rubber pond liner to eliminate all the clams. So while this works, what you should probably do is look at isolated populations of these clams and admit that maybe you've lost the battle where they're all across the southeast shore of the lake, you're not going to get rid of them from there. So our interaction with TRPA comes in the form of, they have a problem, they have some funds to deal with it. Usually it goes to competitive bid. If we're the ones that have the best proposal to do the work, we do the work, provide them the answers, and some recommendations on how they might use those answers but we do that a lot. And we're in committee meetings with them, so we know what their concerns are. And it's almost an advisory consultant relationship when it comes down to it. All right. This gets more into fish in the lake and some of the invasive species. This information is also, again, there's those panels over there of what fish are here, the old food web, the new food web, and the timeline going through the visitor center in there. This was put together by Christine, she'll go by Ryan now, Christine Ryan at UNR, and Sudeep Chandra, who is the professor down there that runs the lab. They do a fair amount of work up here, and so we cooperated with them. It was nice to put my name on it, which means I get to talk about it. And so, non-native versus invasive. There are differences. Non-native is basically non-indigenous, exotic, alien. Those are all terms kind of saying the same thing. It's a species that wasn't, it's living beyond its original habitat and bounds. Not necessarily a problem. An invasive species is a species that was living beyond its original bounds that creates a nuisance or some kind of detriment to the environment. And so if we talk non-native, we could talk about Kokanee salmon. They were introduced to the lake, lake trout. The rainbow trout were not here normally. Those are non-native. They're not necessarily creating a negative impact on other species in the lake or the environment. If we talk about quagga mussel that is not in the lake, but we're trying to keep out, if they got in here, that would be an invasive species. They plug up drain pipes, they foul boats, they'd be all over the rocks and you wouldn't be able to walk on the rocks. They create a nuisance. Okay, so a little quiz here she threw in. Lake trout? Native or non-native?
Non-native.
Very good. Largemouth bass?
Non-native.
Mahan red-sided shiners?
Native.
Yes. Beautiful fish plant, by the way, too. If you get to look at them underwater, put a face mask on, go in, they're really pretty. Bullhead catfish?
Non-native.
And ugly. Here's a real easy one, a Tahoe sucker. They're all over the casinos. Native. So there are other non-natives. Again, these are the Asian clams. Crayfish are non-native. They were introduced in the early 1920s. We do have big goldfish, primarily in the Tahoe Keys. Somebody didn't want to flush their little goldfish after they had raised it up. So they're leaving their summer house and they pour it into the lake and now we've got goldfish. And they get quite large. And then Eurasian water meltwell also. So biological innovations are not only anthropogenic. I have a little bit of an issue with this slide, but anthropogenic being human-induced. You can't have species shifting their natural range and ending up in a new area and then dominating it when they get in there. It's pretty hard to come up with those. Mostly, when species get into a new area, it's because we transported them. And occasionally I get the comment of, well, why are we spending billions of dollars on invasive species when we ourselves are an invasive species? We are not an invasive species. We are a species that immigrates. Under our own power, we go to new areas and we exploit it. That would be the same as a fish naturally swimming up a river into a new lake and exploiting it. That's very different than an animal that could never have gotten to its new location, but got there because we put it there. So there's definitely differences. I do not consider humans to be invasive. I consider us to be immigrants. We're very good at immigrating and exploiting. But something like the clams. The clams can't get up from southern Nevada, jog up Highway 395 and come to the top. We have to do it for them. But they create a lot of problems. So 87 non-native aquatic species have been accidentally introduced in the Great Lakes in the 20th century, primarily from boat bilges. That's the main thing they get there. This is just freshwater fish around the world. You can see what happens when you do. These are intentional. Freshwater fish don't jump out of a lake in Tahoe and run to New Zealand. They don't swim through the ocean, they're freshwater. So this is what we have done. And invasive species can cause detrimental environmental and economic issues, some big economic issues. And this is what quagga mussel and zebra mussels do to things that, let's think of the lake. This is a shopping cart, completely covered. You can't even tell, other than the shape of it, you can't even tell it's a shopping cart. And boat hulls. Not only is it just a nuisance to the boat, this probably slows the boat down about maybe cuts 25% of its speed off the boat. So energy consumption goes way up, trying to maintain speed on the boat. And you can read through this, they in 1 year after the introduction, the densities got up to 35,000 per square meter. It's like one of these floor tiles having 35,000 mussels on it. This is why we want to keep these out of Lake Tahoe. This is why we have that big boat wash inspection program. I went for the first time yesterday to go see the whole process of the boat inspections. And if you haven't tried to launch a boat at Tahoe and you want to see what it's all about, I highly recommend it. I asked a lot of questions, people are great, and they're a very efficient process and they know why they're there doing what they're doing. It's a great program. But it's to keep these guys out. And I asked the guy, I said, how many, I was at the Alpine Meadows one. I said, how many boats do you see that are infested each summer? He says, well, the ones that we see visually that already have mussels on them, we get two a month. That's two boats that would be in Tahoe every month from that one station. There's five of those boat inspection stations around the lake. So you're looking at somewhere between 6 and 10 boats infected each year, or each month coming into Tahoe that's being prevented. That's only the ones they can see, because anything holding water in the boat could be holding the larval stages of these animals also. And as soon as the bilge kicks on or they pull the boat out of the water and the engine drains, they're going into Tahoe. So they treat all of the boats that have any wet spaces. Actually, watch the pull. There were wet life jackets that were in a forward compartment of this one boat. They pulled them out and they pressure washed them with 140 degree water just to make sure there weren't any non-visible invasive species on it. And here's where it really hurts. And cost of, because they get into all the water systems, $20 million, not including the operation and maintenance of that system. So it goes up into the millions very quickly. Once these species become established, it is virtually impossible to get rid of them. You can manage them, you can treat them in certain areas, but as a lake-wide system, you're probably not going to eradicate them. Here's just another example locally. Lake Davis in Portola, somebody put northern pike in there, and it was a trophy trout fishing lake. Northern pike grew big, ate all the trout, and so they wanted to get rid of the northern pike. They did a treatment in 1997, which did not completely work, only cost $16 million. They had to go back in 2007 and spend another $17 million and get rid of the pike. And so $33 million in a small lake in Northern California. Okay, this gets more into Tahoe, the food web. Historically, Tahoe had this very short food web. All the organisms evolved together in the lake. They were very good at eating each other and reproducing in the system that Tahoe was. So we have the phytoplankton, the algae. We have the Daphnia and the other zooplankton that we still see out there feeding on that algae. We had fish eating those zooplankton. And then we had bigger fish eating those fish. Short, direct, simple, sweet. Then we threw in a bunch of other species and created a food web that is very inefficient, has dead ends, it doesn't work as well. This exact timeline you can find over here. There's plenty of time to look at it. But basically, starting in the late 1800s and continuing through intentional introductions, these are all intentional in this area, up to about to the shrimp in 1965. That was intentional. We were trying to produce more fish out of the lake. Crayfish, food for fish, food for people. Mice and shrimp, food for fish. And then This really started about 1990s when we saw these unintentional introductions or unsanctioned introductions. I believe the bass is intentional by an angler, but certainly not sanctioned by Fish and Game or any of the agencies. So here's our historic food web. I'm just going to kind of go past this one pretty quickly, mainly because it's right on the wall over there and you can see it better. But Lahontan cutthroat trout being top predator, other fish eating zooplankton, benthic, small fish. There's some connection to the small fish as well, and ultimately the phytoplankton being the bottom food chain. Then we have the current food web, and much more disjunct. It's not one example of this is that lake trout grow up to, in Tahoe, there's probably a half dozen every year that are caught over 20 pounds. These fish are big. Big gaping mouth, huge teeth. Teeth look like Dobermans on a fish. They're eating nice as shrimp. Okay, they're designed to eat other fish. They're a top predator, and they're going around picking up these little teeny shrimp. Very inefficient way of feeding. The shrimp do a daily migration as much as 1,000 feet vertically in the water column. So at night, they're up at the top. Sunrise starts, they're down at the bottom. Night, back at the top again. If you're 3/4 to 3/4 inch long and you're swimming through something as viscous and thick as water, 1,000 feet each direction, 2,000 feet every 24 hours, enormous energy burn. And then what eats you? A giant fish that isn't designed to. These are the kind of inefficiencies that we put into the new food web. That wouldn't have existed naturally in any system. And crayfish densities are increasing. And there's some estimates now that they're up to 60 million crayfish in the lake. Not exactly sure how it's playing out, but there is the commercial harvest of crayfish happening on the Nevada side for consumption, human consumption. So they're actually harvesting with traps crayfish on the Nevada side. California hasn't permitted it yet. The benthic invertebrates, these are the little guys in the bottom of the sediment that nobody ever sees, but when you're a scientist and you grab and you look at these things, and there's been a dramatic drop off over time in the last 40, 50 years. And again, it's related to having these different species shifts happening in the lake and who's feeding on them. Watercraft inspections, I mentioned this. This information, some of it's available on this table here. It's readily available online. And I do highly recommend taking an hour out of your day at some point and going and watching them go through a boat inspection. It's pretty interesting. Things we can do to help, don't use live bait. You're allowed to use live bait in Tahoe if you caught the live bait in Tahoe. So you can use the Lahontan Redside Shiners as bait, but you can't go to Donner Lake or Stampede Reservoir, catch fish there, and bring them over for bait here. You can only use the minnows from Tahoe for bait. Go to our education center, visit our incredible education outreach team, learn all you can learn. Talk to our doses. Thank you.
What happened to the Lahontan cutthroat trout? Why did they go extinct?
They were overfished because there was a commercial fishery for Lahontan cutthroats. So the last Lahontan cutthroat was caught in Lake Tahoe in 1931. And the commercial fishery was taking as much as 100,000 pounds of cutthroat a year. That was kind of the peak. Putting them on the trains and sending them as far east as Chicago for restaurants. And San Francisco also, it was the mountain spotted trout delicacy. The problem is they were harvesting way beyond the sustainability.
Overfished.
The other problem is that they built Derby Dam and other dams on the Truckee River because there used to be a connected system from Pyramid Lake, which had cutthroat, all the way up the Truckee into Lake Tahoe. And when they put the dams in, they cut off the supply of fish that weren't being overfished from Pyramid Lake. They could no longer get up here into Lake Tahoe. Then we cut down all the trees in the Tahoe Basin to support the silver mines. So all of the spawning streams silted in. So destruction of habitat, dams, overfishing.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Anything else? Yeah.
Just
so I understand, but now as you try to introduce them, the brown trout, like, would be one of the cutthroat trout?
Yeah, there's a Nevada Department of, or no, it's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a program that they've been working on for quite a few years to try and establish cutthroat trout populations back in Lake Tahoe. They've done a lot of genetic work to try and get the closest strain they can to use to the historic strain. They've done a lot of really good work on trying to figure out how to make this work, how to make it happen. And the difficulty is, one of the other confounding factors is that lake trout and the lake love to eat cutthroat trout. So those were put in the late 1800s at the same time the overfishing was happening and all that. So the dam still exists, so Tahoe population would have to survive on its own, which it could. We could have a population here of cutthroat. We've gotten rid of the timber harvest and the silting of the streams, so spawning is a very real possibility. But we haven't gotten rid of the predation issue with the lake trout, and that's a big one. Lake trout can eat fish up to half of their own size. So if you have a 20-inch lake trout in Lake Tahoe, which is about the average size fish, they can eat a 10-inch cutthroat. So your cutthroat have to be able to grow pretty large before they escape predation, and that's just a really difficult thing.
They don't eliminate the brown or the rainbows?
They don't. It's interesting that they do feed on, but they're spatially separated in the lake. The lake trout tend to be from about 100 feet on down deeper, actually right below the thermocline, down deeper. Rainbows and browns. Browns love warm water. They'll swim around that really uncomfortable surface water. The rainbows hang out kind of above the thermocline. They're surface feeders a lot, so they're eating insects. Unfortunately, the cutthroat like to be right at that thermocline and feeding on bottom organisms and zooplankton. And so they overlap the lake trout a lot. So it's really a spatial issue of where they're trying to take up residence. Yeah.
They introduced a hybrid cutbows in Dawn Lake about 20 years ago. How did they work out?
Similar problem. If they act like a cutthroat, lake trout, they tend to interact with lake trout and lose. Mm-hmm. And rainbows do as well. A guy caught a really good fisherman over there, caught a 25-pound lake trout out of Donner Lake. And he normally releases them all. And this one was bleeding from when he caught it, and it died. So he brought it over to me, and I used it for a class that we teach here, and it had 5 planted rainbow trout in its stomach. So it had 5 7-inch rainbows in its stomach. So they definitely eat rainbows, especially at Donner Lake. When the fish and game truck backs up with the rainbow trout to plant the lake, it's like ringing the dinner bell for the lake trout. They come swimming over.